Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
Welcome to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham on AM 770 KTTH. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Know Your Risk Radio is brought to you by Bulwark Capital Management, helping families navigate the ever-changing and often treacherous financial markets. Know Your Risk Radio starts now. Here's your host, Zach Abraham.
And we made it. Another week. Welcome back to the show. Another crazy week, but great to have you with us for the most scintillating hour in finance radio. I'm just always going to laugh a little bit when I say that. But anyway, just, I've said it for, what, a month now? Multiple months. So much to discuss and talk about. Crazy action. And when I say that, I don't say, you know, look, you got to get up here and talk to you guys once a week. Got to do the show. No one's going to, I wouldn't think anybody's going to step up here. Yeah, well, you know, things are boring. But no, seriously, if you are a finance professional, a interested watcher on the side, whatever the case is, if you have an interest or a passion in finance and investing, this current world is crazy, but it's endlessly fascinating. And, it just keeps on coming at you. So much to discuss. We got a great show planned for you today. As always, we're going to be joined a little bit later in the show by our favorite Aussie, Mr. Deep Value himself, Tobias Carlyle. If you're a Twitter person, And for those of you that listen to the radio show on a regular basis or listen to the podcast, and if you're not on Twitter, I would recommend that you are. And what you need to realize is you're not going to be subject, if you're not familiar with Twitter, you're not going to be subject to the deluge of information. The things you see are going to be related to kind of the things you follow. So if you follow me or you follow Tobias, which is at Greenbacked, G-R-E-E-N, B-A-C-K-D, just look up Tobias Carlyle Twitter, he'll come up. But if you follow finance guys, that's all you're going to see. And what's fascinating is there's an unbelievable amount of very well-known, very reputable money managers and economists that are posting on a daily basis, posting their stuff. It shocked me because I'm not a social media guy at all. As a matter of fact, Twitter was the very first and only social media I've ever engaged in. And it really is kind of for us in the industry, most know, but it really is kind of an unknown source. I actually do research on Twitter, believe it or not. I would just strongly say, if you listen to this show on a regular basis, you're going to love some of the stuff you get on there. There's also a bunch of other great finance podcasts. Tobias has one of them. And I've actually been on his before. So anyway, couldn't encourage you enough to get on there. But we're going to start with the market update. We're going to hit a few segments before we're joined by Tobias. But obviously, want to get into the market update. And it's fitting that we have Tobias on because he's much like me. We approach it at different angles, different techniques, things like that. But we're value guys, right? We're looking for undervalued things. We're not chasing momentum. We're not trying to read technicals all the time. Do we look at things like that? Sure, it goes into the thought process. But for us, and I know Tobias is very much the same, we are trying to buy undervalued assets, right? It's the Warren Buffett approach. We want to buy things below their intrinsic value and sell them, hopefully, when they get above their intrinsic value. And that's sort of the way markets move, right? That's the natural ebb and flow of things. Things get overvalued, things get undervalued. Very rarely are things fairly valued, interestingly enough. So anyway, but he's going to be great to discuss that with. And that's going to parlay. When we talk about the natural flow of markets, I think it's going to parlay great into our next segment, our very first segment, which is talking about the Fed. We talked about the Fed last week, and I went on a rant, which I really enjoyed. And if you hear that little ding in the background, that's my phone. Got a new phone, Darren. Had to re-phone it, which when you're cheap like I am, it's really irritating. You know, you had to go in there and bite the bullet on a new phone. But it was odd. Went to go pick it up. Just, you know, plugged it in, normal night, all that kind of stuff. Go pick it up. It's just dead. It wouldn't even register a charge sign. It's just like the thing imploded overnight. I don't know. I like to think it's because I stressed its microprocessor so greatly by the deluge of constant research, right? when in all actuality, it's probably just, you know, plugged into my, I don't know, whatever. Anyway, back to what I was discussing before I got derailed. See, that's all it takes. Just a little ding by a phone. Anyway, please excuse that. But went on an anti-Fed rant yesterday or last week and want to dig a little bit deeper into that just because, again, I hate it. I hate it when people talk in platitudes. I hate it when people talk in generalities and just spray something out there and we end up either agreeing or disagreeing with it and we don't even really know why. So I want to dig a little bit deeper into the great danger and destruction that I think central banks have had on markets, are certainly having on them now, and that I believe will continue to actually reap greater havoc into the future and into the not so distant future, unfortunately. And look, right, one of the ways that we approach things on the investment side is we are building portfolios that are going to work for our clients regardless of whether we're right or wrong. I hope I'm wrong. Guys, I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't want to be wrong. Right? It's not like you form an opinion hoping that you're wrong. But if I'm wrong, asset prices go up, houses keep... Look, it's great. I really do hope that this, you know, MMT, modern monetary theory, debt doesn't matter. Sign me up, right? I just know that that's not the case. Right. I was taught something in my childhood that stuck with me, that there is no free lunch, that everything has unintended consequences, intended and unintended. Right. You can't get something for nothing. Right. That everything has knock on effects. And but like I said, you know, we're not making one way bets. Right? That's a horrible way to manage money. We're setting up client portfolios that win either way. But here's something really interesting. We're at a break point. We had Raul Paul on not too long ago, and he talked about all the recessionary indicators. Unfortunately, all of that is still in play. We've got some conflicting data points that have come out this week. I think we've also got some greatly misunderstood data points that have come out this week. Once again, I want to reiterate, as it relates to the markets and the economy as a whole, that I don't see red lights. Right. But I see a lot of yellow lights. And I would say one red light would be the inverted yield curve. That's troubling. But at the same time, you got to understand something. Markets typically don't dive. I mean, the trend is when you get a yield curve inversion, you typically don't get a recession until, you know, some point in the next 16 months out. That's the average. It happens sooner, you know, later at other times. But it doesn't mean necessarily impending doom, right? But we want to look at all the data. And I think right now, one of the confusing things about it is whether you're bullish the economy and bullish the stock market or whatever, or whether you're bearish, there's enough data on both sides to really, you know, grab onto. I think at this point, when you include the inverted yield curve, when you include the ISM reports, I think that there is more data lining up on the bear side. But look, we've seen it again. We've seen worse ISM reports back in 16. We saw two quarters of negative earnings in 16. That has not happened this year. And I said before it was going to happen. It was baked into the cake. I was wrong. I mean, it wasn't impressive. We weren't far off. And you know, there was some... Anyway, I was wrong, though. There were positive earnings. Not, you know, not big surprises. They didn't blow it out or anything. But anyway, there's a lot of flashing yellow lights, not a lot of red ones. There are a couple. But, you know, I don't want to be hyperbolic. I don't want to try to scare people at all. But one of those data points recently was the jobs report that came out. Again, people on the bullish side, well, oh, look, everything's fine. People on the bearish side weren't. The thing that I thought was interesting is, again, right, not reading the headlines, digging down to the details of that jobs report. It beat estimates. Wasn't great, but wasn't horrible, wasn't recessionary. Job growth is clearly slowing. That is clearly a trend. But the interesting thing is the jobs report would have looked a lot worse had it not been for all the people that have been hired to do the census. And I haven't heard many people talking about that, but if you dig through the details and you see where those jobs are coming from, it's pretty much flat to negative in every other category except services. And then you look at the, you know, the people that were picked up for the census and you break it down. Not bad, certainly not good though. And it's funny watching the people try to spin it on both sides. Whereas what we're trying to do here, as always, right, we want to get it right. So if it's inconclusive, you got to come to the decision that it's inconclusive. But don't get me wrong, right? There are troubling signs out there. New home starts have basically flatlined. I think they're a little bit positive, but they basically flatlined. Haven't really rebounded from the crushing they got last year. But now, you know, mortgage rates have just hit, I think, 30 years back down to 3.5. So that might take a little while to transmit into the economy. But, you know, a lot of, again, just a lot of different data points out there and a lot of things to keep an eye on. The thing that I keep going back to, though, is the fundamentals. And again, it's, you know, we're lucky to have Tobias join us today so we can talk about value, because I met with some new clients or some people that we've been talking to for a while about becoming clients. We're bringing them on board now and met with them yesterday. And again, we're recording this show on Friday. So when I say yesterday, I mean Thursday. But met with them yesterday and discussed, you know, how we do things, how we look at things. And, you know, they were at a lot of questions about the economy and the market as a whole. And I said, look, you know, kind of giving them the same discussion that we're having now. And just said, look, guys, as it goes to market direction and asset prices in general, nobody really knows. No, not really. Nobody knows, right? Markets can do anything they want. But in times like these, I think it's so important to stick with the discipline, right? Stick with the disciplined approach. And I think that what you've got to go back on when you've got all these wild cards and China trade deals and is the Fed going to pump and what's that impact going to be? And we've got recessionary signals, we got signals, we got bullish signals. What does it all mean? Look, you can, and I've done it. You can spin your wheels for hours trying to figure this out. It's not going to happen. Okay, you're not going to predict it. If you get it right, there is an aspect of luck involved. Okay, because there's all these things floating around us that we have no control over, and that we can't know. But what we do know is valuation, value. And what is the single most important defining characteristic of an investment and whether we categorize it a good investment or a bad investment? Say it out loud in your car if you know. It's the price you pay. So when we are buying things today, especially mainstream things, especially funds, especially ETFs, especially stocks that you hear people discussing on CNBC, you need to be aware of something. You are paying near record prices, if not absolute all-time record prices for stocks. Does that mean you sell everything and run away? No. What it means is the focus should be on capital preservation and safety. And I've brought it up a million times. I'll keep bringing it up. I'll keep beating it on the table until you're so sick of hearing it. You end up picketing the front of Cairo and you're like, do not let that schmuck back on the air. This is when you go back to value. This is why Warren Buffett has over $120 billion of cash sitting on the balance sheet, right? Could I see stocks making incredible gains over the next 2 years? Yeah, it's certainly feasible. Okay, but what are we doing in retirement? We are funding retirement. We are not a hedge fund. We're not trying to outperform the S&P. Have realistic goals. And in times like these, when valuations are sky high, you don't need to be focused on trying to beat it. You don't need to be focused on trying to post the biggest returns. The biggest returns are always made in down markets when you pay the least for the investments. And they will come. A lot of people are talking like they never will. And again, I don't want to blow our topic here, but Tobias and I are going to discuss that as well. But you got to stick with it. Interesting thing, and I'm kind of skipping around here in the market update, but I don't want to blow it because a lot of our market update, we're going to discuss with Tobias coming up. But one of the interesting things we've seen is in this upsurge this week that we've had, which came out of, and let me address this really quick. I don't think that a trade deal is going to get done. I don't think China has any incentive to get it done. What I think China has incentive to get done, could I be wrong? Absolutely. But what I think their incentive is to do is to constantly engage, give our markets some hope, and then pull away and drill things again, right? You have things drop and make Trump look as dumb as possible because I firmly believe. This is not an endorsement of Trump by any stretch of the imagination, but I firmly believe that China would rather deal with somebody else. And I think they find him implacable. I think that they think that he is a wild card, that, you know, I think that they would rather deal with a traditional politician. They don't have any incentive. The other thing that you got to consider when we're discussing China is you've got to consider the cultural side of it, right? You know, respect and not losing face is so important. It's such a highly valued part of the makeup of the Chinese people, a lot of Asian cultures for that matter. And by capitulating to Trump, first of all, I think it would hurt them economically. But just as importantly, maybe more importantly, it would be seen as a knock to the bravado or the machismo of Xi Jinping. And I don't think that's something that they're going to do. And that's why I think you see this sporadic, we're back on the table talking, then we're pulling away and nothing's really changed and back and forth we go, right? I think their goal is just to keep reengaging and fluster Trump and make him look as stupid as possible and cause as much havoc and as much volatility as they possibly can in our markets. I think that's what the deal is. So don't bet on a China trade deal. If you get one, my guess is that it will be meaningless, unfortunately. And in that case, regardless of what ramifications that play out in the markets, I hope Trump sticks to his guns. I think it's the most important thing, or one of the top two or three most important things that he would address in his presidency. Just because I don't think a lot of other politicians have the incentive to do it. I think that some of them are in the pocket of the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, and, you know, they got a lot of money, throwing a lot of money around. But getting back to the markets, what's really interesting is we've seen this upsurge now based on this hopium, right, of, oh, the trade deal's back on, you know, these crazy erratic market moves. But what we're seeing is, you know, like today, you got the Dow Jones up 0.32, you got the S&P up 0.25%, NASDAQ is essentially flat on the day. Now, that's kind of the inverse of the trend of the last, you know, 8 years, 9 years. And what you've seen is you've seen value start catching a bid. It's early. Again, we've been seeing signs of this. We've been telling you, we've been seeing signs of this for quite some time. But that's really interesting on a risk on move. Markets up big, 379 points. We're not used to seeing the value type stocks, the dividend payers leading the charge. And that's a little bit different. That suggests some market rotation. And why that applies to you is if you're a normal investor out there and you own ETFs and mutual funds and that kind of stuff, you are so much more exposed to a lot of these ridiculously priced tech stocks than you realize. And you're going to get slammed. And if you're concerned about that, if you're interested in our risk mitigating process, our risk managed portfolios, here's the other thing, guys. There's another point, okay? If this is just a growth scare, like we saw in 2016, and the economy is going to take an upturn, rates are going to go back up, right? This is the thing we've been pounding the table on ever since we came on the air. Rates are going to go back up. When rates start going back up, the defense part of your portfolio, those bonds that, by the way, haven't been doing their job for 10 years, but those bonds are going to get hammered. Okay? That's where our bond replacement strategy comes in. It's insured against loss, no cost, and you rise with the market as it goes up. And the type of products we use is they have no fees and they have no caps. You're not going to make 10, 12, 13% a year in these things. They're not designed to outperform stocks. But we've seen them average 5.5%, 6.5%, you know, all the time. That's not a guarantee of performance. There is none. It's market related. But what I'm saying is these things average right in that ballpark, that 5, 6% range. Hey, that's what we want out of bonds, right? But most importantly, you got no fees, right? And if the market does go nuts to the upside, you're not sitting on the sidelines collecting 2% in treasuries or, you know, 0.3% in your money market account. You're participating to the upside. And these things, because they have no cap on their upside performance, you know, we've seen them have 13, 14, 15, 17% gains in a single year. It's not snake oil. Said it all the time. It exists. We can get you safer, give you more upside, cut your fees. Then on the stock side of it, we're going to focus in defensive things, stock portfolios that have protection built into them that eliminate or greatly reduce the risk of a catastrophic loss. And we're focused on value in a market that doesn't care about it. It's probably a pretty good place to be. But anyway, if that interests you, give us a call. 866-779-RISK, again, 866-779-RISK. You can talk to me directly. You can talk to one of our other reps. We can do a phone consultation. If you don't want to talk on the phone, that seems like too big a stretch, you can email us in. You can request our free booklet, sign up for our weekly newsletter that we send out to our clients. It's kind of a market summary, a little more in-depth than what we do here in the market update. And you can get, like I said, you get the free booklet. You can register for the podcast. You can go to knowyourriskradio.com, bulwarkcapitalmanagement.com to get to the podcast. You can just Google Know Your Risk Radio Stitcher. And plenty of resources. You guys know the drill. Anyway, we got to roll. And when we come back, we're going to be joined by Tobias Carlyle. And I'm really looking forward to it. Always love talking to Tobias. And hopefully you guys get something out of it. So anyway, stick with us. We'll be right back. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
What does outside-the-box investing really look like? Schedule your free risk review with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management. And see a side-by-side comparison of your current portfolio versus one Zach would recommend. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com.
Hey, it's Tory Monson with Brian Ott from 525 Advisors and host of Long Term Care Radio. And Brian, we have another great question from a listener. What is the best age to look into long-term care insurance?
You know, Dory, we have plans that will help people up to age 85, but here's what you need to know. It's not your age that allows you to get long-term care insurance. It's your health. So the best time to look into getting a plan is when you're healthy and you can still qualify. If you have a question for me, send it to me at 525longtermcare.com. You can also learn about the new programs that pay you back if you never use your plan, and you can sign up for one of our free upcoming classes. And don't forget to join me every Saturday morning on Cairo for Long-Term Care Radio.
We indeed chose the best plan that pays us back if we never use it. Learn what may be the best option for you at one of Brian's upcoming classes, Friday, September 20th or Saturday the 21st. Seating's limited, so sign up today at 525longtermcare.com. Classes are free, and you'll even get a copy of Brian's book. Go to 525longtermcare.com.
We've all heard the term buy low and sell high, and markets have recently hit another all-time high. And that begs the question, is this the top? Hey, it's Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital and host of Know Your Risk Radio. Is this the top? No one knows. The truth is, we no longer need to know. By using our risk-managed stock portfolios and Bulwark's bond replacement strategy, we can lower your fees, increase your upside, and drastically reduce your risk exposure. This is now the longest bull market in U.S. financial history, and stock valuations have never been higher. So why risk it? Call now to get your free copy of our brand new booklet, Common Sense Investing, and learn how to protect your retirement against loss, but still participate in market gains. Call 866-779-RISK, 866-779-RISK, or go to knowyourriskradio.com.
Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement in place where the firm is licensed to conduct business. Bulwark Capital Management's a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, registered investment advisor.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
All right, welcome back to the show, and thank you so much for joining us. And without further ado, got to get into our little special guest interview we've got today with our favorite Aussie, the Thunder from Down Under himself, Mr. Tobias Carlisle. Tobias, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, Zach, thanks so much for having me on again. I love chatting to you.
Yeah, we haven't talked in a while. I think it's the last time I was on your podcast and really enjoyed it. And for everybody that's listening, and I actually said this, I actually said this in the opening monologue. I said they should follow you on Twitter, at Greenback, or just, you know, Google Tobias or Tobias Carlisle Twitter. And then also, one of the great reasons to follow you is because you do a podcast and a show as well, and you've been cranking out some great guests. I really loved the episode you did with Ian Castle. Just thought he was a real fascinating guy.
Yeah, Ian's an amazing guy. Your podcast was very, very popular, I should say. People love that crossover, I think, that you do so well between kind of looking at precious metals and thinking a little bit more strategically, but also marrying that with the value, which I think kind of makes you unique out there. I don't think there are many guys doing that.
Yeah, unique. I'm sure you felt sort of quote unquote unique over the last 5-6 years, right? What a run. I mean, it's just been a pain trade to be a value guy, hasn't it?
It has been unbelievable, really. I mean, I've been, you haven't heard from me much because I've been in a bunker with the door shut waiting for the storm to come.
Yeah.
And it hasn't come yet, but I still think it's coming. But value has been, I always think that value tends to retreat a little bit before the market kind of gets the message. So I think that value investors, the bid goes away for a lot of value stocks. And then that kind of catches the market. But this, I've seen it's happened repeatedly over the last 5 years that value has this very serious sell-off, you know, like a 20% style sell-off, which is the old definition of a bear market. Nobody's seen one for a decade, so no one knows what one looks like in the actual market. But value's certainly seen a few. I don't really know what's driving it, but that last month, August, was absolutely horrific for value investors because the things that value guys, the factors that they most closely match to, and I'm the same, is value for one thing. But value's got a funny definition because it's price to book, and nobody really uses price to book. But the other thing we often track quite closely to is quality. And quality is cash on the balance sheet, cash flows, buying back stock, all the kind of things that healthy companies do. And so value guys are always trying to find undervalued healthy companies that can probably survive. And that was absolutely smashed to pieces again, which is really odd. It doesn't make a great deal of sense, but the seems that the more money a company loses, the better it does these days.
No kidding. I and you and I, this is not the first time that we've licked our wounds together. And the discrepancy in the valuations of these things, you know, I've been on the air talking about this now for 3 years, but it just keeps getting wider and wider and wider, even to the point where if you're lucky enough to have a couple names that for whatever reason were value plays when you bought them, but were able to catch an updraft. Even some of our long-held favorites have gotten, now I mean only like one or two, just because, you know, that whole wreck that's been value investing has certainly taken a toll on us as well. But even some of the names that we liked for a while, we're sitting there looking back at them going, you know, I love this company, we believe in it, but the price of this thing, you know what I mean? I think so often investors write, certainly people in the media, write this stuff off. as saying, oh, it's sour grapes, right? You're just mad because you haven't been on the right side of the trade. I'm saying even the stuff that's worked for us, I'm looking at and scratching my head going, man, you know, we've got Costco. We were talking about this before we got on the air. We're investors in Costco. That's not a recommendation to buy or sell or short it or anything like that. But we've held it for a long time. Love the company. Believe in the company. Love what it's doing. Love the performance. That thing's pushing a 40 PE, man. I mean,
Costco is a great business because you got Charlie Munger on the board there, and Charlie Munger's long been a supporter of it. They do some really special things that mean that they're one of the premier retail businesses in the States,
yep.
Which is saying something because there are some great retailers out there. But even for Costco, it's still retail.
Right.
40's rich.
Right. Right. And like I said, a 40 PE on this thing. I mean, you know, And we don't even need to get in there and discuss the, you know, the real crazy ones. But what are you seeing? Now, the one thing I really was looking forward to, and I was teasing before you came on the air, is I hate to get my hopes up, but it has looked a bit strange. We're watching, especially this week, prime example, we're watching an upsurge, a pretty aggressive move higher on a risk-off or risk-on move in the markets now. And you're seeing a lot of these momentum names that have been everybody's darlings really kind of sitting this out and value catching a bid. Do you think we're seeing a one-week anomaly here? Or what is your take on that?
Look, I've been burned a few times calling the turn in value's fortune, so I'm very, very nervous about calling it. But I've seen the same thing. There's been a very strong bid in the undervalued quality names, which I haven't seen for a long time. And typically that you're right, that's been any time that value catches a bid, the momentum names are blasting off to the moon. But that didn't seem to happen this time around. If anything, the more overvalued kind of frothy names have been a little bit weak over the last week. And so I don't really know when this is going to turn. This is one of the problems with value, that it's just not a great timing mechanism, because, you know, if you think that something's undervalued and you think it, you're sort of saying that the market's got it wrong, there's no reason why it can't get it more wrong over the short term. And you're sort of hoping that over a longer period of time, typically that means 3 to 5 years, that the underlying value gets recognized by the market, and whatever the near term crisis that's causing that gap between value and price to open up, that can get wider. And so I've been in a lot of these names that I think that they're really cheap. They're generating free cash flow, which you always like to see. You don't have to pay very much for that free cash flow, and they're using it for sensible stuff. You know, they're paying down debt, they're buying back stock, they're reinvesting at a rate, they're growing at a higher rate than the market. That's one thing that a lot of people miss. And for whatever reason, they're just in sectors that people don't like. So financials has a bit of an overhang from the GFC and probably from the global financial crisis, the credit crisis in 2007-09. Probably that's well-deserved, because the behavior at the time was terrible.
Yep.
And they were they were holding too much debt, doing really silly things, so that the income and the cash flows weren't high quality. But they've reformed over the last decade. Some of that has been legislative, and some of that has just been a better market for them and not doing so many of the silly things. But financials are one in particular. And in the fund, in the acquirers fund, which the ticker is ZIG, we've got a big concentration in there because they've got healthy balance sheets. They're doing pretty well lending money out. If anything, they're overcapitalized as a result of some of the legislative reforms that have come in. So I think that they're reasonably safe. And in contrast, you know, the things that have been the most popular over the last decade, technology, those are starting to look very, very junky to me. They've got a lot of debt on the balance sheet, and Netflix is a prime example of that. If you take a look at Netflix, they've got negative free cash flow, which means that they're not earning enough money to pay for their the shows that they're producing. And then they're carrying an enormous amount of debt. I think they've got about $10 billion in debt on that balance sheet. You know, it doesn't take much competition, and that's the problem for them. There's a lot of it coming in. For that business to start to struggle a little bit, like, the competition is Disney. If you've got little kids, you've almost got to get Disney. To pay for a Disney channel, you pay $8 a month. Netflix is twice as much.
Yeah, Yeah.
There's some serious competition in there right at the time that they're losing money with the debt. I think that as a sort of poster child for what's been going on, Netflix is going to be in a little bit of trouble over the next few quarters at least.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. And you know, like you said, value is not a good timing mechanism. You either can take our word for that or you can learn it like we have. It's not a good timing mechanism. That being said, I will say this. It does feel to me you know, the bloom is off the flower, the bloom's off the rose. Now, how quickly that correlates to markets, you know, reacting to that and you know, starting to act accordingly, who knows? But if you look at a lot of these names, and Netflix has been one that we've focused on, good company. I like what they've done. But if you look at the valuation of the thing, let's pretend that you and I are kind of like everybody else, you know, where we don't even look at the balance sheet or the cash flow statement. We just, you know, read the story, watch a little bit of Jim Cramer, and then just pull the trigger
on
investments.
Look at the revenue line.
Yeah, exactly. That's all we're carrying. If you just look at the revenue line on these names, if you just look at it the way that everybody is, even that is, that's not making a lot of sense, right? Just look at the way that Netflix is growing revenues and then look at the multiple. That's not matching up anymore. This is not a company that deserves even the top line growth, even the profitless top line growth that they're pulling off anymore. And I just think everybody's sort of, you know, I mean, yeah, they're going, oh, yeah, Netflix has gotten hit. Yeah, it has. But look at the multiple it's still sporting. What does everybody think that business model is about to reaccelerate? You look at several of these other names, too. I mean, some of the high flyers, we've seen multiple expansion and underlying slowdowns, not meaningful, not drops, but the growth rate is decelerating, and the growth rate's the whole story. Have you noticed that as well?
Absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely right there. That's exactly the thing that is driving the valuations, is that the growth has been so high in these names. But it's been a funny kind of growth. It's a profitless growth, and it doesn't seem to fall to the it doesn't even generate cash flow for them that they can use to fund the business. The way that they fund the business is by selling stock. So they use that very high valuation to sell shares. That's what funds the business until they get to the next point, do it again. And another company that's in the same kind of vein as Netflix, I think, is Tesla.
Yep.
The cars are very nice. I'm not disputing that the cars are very nice. I think it's great for the environment. The issue is, and there's definitely demand there. The top line growth is good. The issue is that again, they've got an enormous amount of debt. That top line revenue growth doesn't translate into cash flow falling to the bottom line. They've got massively negative cash flow, and that has to be funded somehow. And the way that they've been funding it in the past is by selling stock. But they're at that point now where the valuation has come off Tesla quite a lot. It's going to be much, much harder for them to sell stock in this market, particularly when there are a lot of these hotter IPOs like the WeWork. We can talk about WeWork a little bit. That's the leasing short-term office space company. I think that if that gets to market, it'll be a miracle. But if it does, it'll be one of those IPOs that tends to trade down very quickly. And I think it'll probably be, in retrospect, you know, the bell for the top of the market, because it's got all of the worst things in it. It's got a lot of debt. It's got a lot of self-dealing between the company and insiders, incredibly complicated structure. And it's one of those businesses that it's really not that interesting. It's just a real estate business that has done what every other real estate business has done since time immemorial, which is take capital, buy real estate or lease real estate, which they tend to do, and then turn around and lease it on a short-term basis to startup businesses in this particular case. That's not a great business model. You got a mismatch between your financing on the long side and the short side. You know, the long side being where you source your property, and then the short side being where you lend it out again, or where you provide the services to your clients. And the clients are short term, and their leases are long term. So if their clients go away, which they very well could in a less attractive market, that could become very ugly very quickly for WeWork. I think it's an absolute disaster, and I don't think anybody should go anywhere near it when it lists.
Oh, no, it is, but it's going to be a fun one to watch. and it's funny because and people listening laugh, take my word for it. But we did not compare notes before we came on, and I actually had WeWork written down as something to talk to you about. And so push a little further into that one. Again, I don't want to be that guy because, you know, you and I have both been doing this long enough to timing markets. If you get it right, you're lucky. Go buy a lottery ticket, and it's a fool's game. At the same time, WeWork is interesting to me because, like I said, the bloom is off the rose with a lot of these names. You see it starting to impact some of their prices. You see some of the shine coming off those names. And I look at WeWork, and WeWork kind of reminds me of that quintessential, possibly, that pivot stock, that pivot story where all of a sudden the realization happens and some of the dominoes start falling. A couple different things that caught my eye is there's a lot of very odd transactions. And I haven't deep dived on it. I've looked at the periphery, but a lot of very odd transactions by the CEO, a lot of strange movements of assets in and out that don't make a whole lot of sense. They kind of have an Enron-esque feel to them, to me. And then the other one is, if they IPO at this price that they're talking about, right? They're talking about taking a 50% haircut. What does that? I mean, think about that. That's just amazing to me that the last round of money they raised, if they can get this IPO off, they're going to IPO at 50% of the last round of private funding. That's unbelievable. And then what does that do to SoftBank's book? And I love SoftBank because I believe SoftBank dropped 98% during the tech crash in something like that, 99% in the tech crash. And I'm wondering, they own a lot of this stuff. You know, it's the Vision Fund, I believe is what they call it. And they got a lot of this stuff on their books. And their interaction with WeWork looked really bizarre. It was almost like they were bidding against themselves, just trying to mark that, you know, mark their balance sheet up. What is your take? Do you think that could be a pivot story? Do you think, have you seen some of these funny transactions? And if you have, do you think that this could be a story that kind of gets people to open their eyes?
Oh, 100%. I mean, whether it makes people open their eyes or not, I don't know. But this is there's some classic kind of amazing things going on in this one. So that Newman, who's the CEO, trademarked the word "we" and then sold that back to the company for $6 million prior to the listing, which is just absolutely bananas that he's allowed to do that. But then there's so much self-dealing. They buy buildings and then they lease them back into the company. The structure is incredibly complicated. I think that you're right that last valuation was a silly one, but that had something to do with SoftBank wanting to mark up its book. So it invested at an earlier round, then invested again at a higher valuation to show that earlier investment was up. As it turns out, that was a completely made up number because there's no way they were going to get the listing done at $47 billion. They've now come back to market at half that level. And I still think they're going to struggle to get it done at half that level. One thing that's not very well known about the SoftBank Vision Fund is it's actually a debt fund. It pays a dividend out of that $100 billion or so that they raised. I mean, that's another thing that could get very, very ugly in this market. And that's how SoftBank tends to be. It could easily be down another 99% in the next drawdown.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, just look at the illiquid names on their balance sheet and look at the investments in these companies they've made, which is, you know, maybe calling some of these companies vaporware is too strong a word. I don't think so. It's got that look to me. And, and to be fair, a lot of these story names that you and I are talking about with the valuations don't make sense. I don't think that the majority of them have something fishy going on or whatever. Just the valuation doesn't make sense, right? You should skip over to a pretty popular name, especially in the retail space. Shopify, good company, great platform, doing great things. But again, look at that valuation. I mean, I was explaining it to somebody, a friend of mine recently, and I said, look, if you got a company that's got a $600 million market cap or something that's growing revenues at 120, 130% a year, okay, maybe, you know, that's pretty rich, obviously, but when you've got a $45 billion market cap and you got $1.3 billion in annual sales or something, I mean, Is it even mathematically possible for a name like that to make money at these prices? I mean, you just scratch your head looking at every, you know, it's hard for me to understand the story, you know, to even get my hands around it.
I'm with you. I think a big difference between now and the late 1990s is that many of the companies that are services, are software as a service, the SaaS businesses, they are very good businesses at their core because it's a good business model. You know, your marginal sale is basically costless because you've already built the software.
Right.
And then often they're on a recurring revenue subscription basis. So the money's predictable and it's coming in, you know, on a regular basis. Those are two great attributes to have in a business. And so these businesses can grow very rapidly and many of them can be very profitable as they grow. Like, that's a great business. And if you can find those businesses at the right price, you should buy them. The problem is that they've performed so well over the last decade with sort of very rarely pulling back and avoiding most of the carnage that the value, that the slower growing names in value have seen, that folks just assume that these things don't ever draw back. And they're just too rich. There's just, you have to be very, very optimistic with the valuations to justify them. And even then, you know, there's kind of a limit to how far these things can grow because the underlying, as you point out, is they're kind of getting closer to market saturation. A $600 million company growing at 100% a year, yeah, you might be able to say, well, this could one day be a $6 billion, $60 billion company because the market is so big, they can service that kind of market. A $45 billion company, at some stage, they just run into the law of large numbers. They just run in, there's just not enough of a market out there to sell into. And then, you know, that very high rate must naturally slow down and the valuation becomes then, you know, you back out that growth part of the valuation, they become extremely expensive. So I sort of think that maybe, you know, these businesses, if you have a list of these names that you really like, and Shopify is a great business. It's just that I don't want to buy it where it is now, and I don't want to buy it probably half of where it is now. I want to buy it maybe one-tenth of where it is now. And I think that what you should do is you should just take a list of these names and you should just wait and have a rough idea of the valuation that you would pay for them and then wait for them to come back to that valuation. There's no reason to chase anything in this market.
No, I completely agree with you. And that kind of goes back to that old principle. Just, I had a client portfolio review 2 days ago where I said, client was concerned about a couple names in particular and was like, you know, we may never see him there again. And I said, hold on, slow down. Right? This is exactly the logic that gets people in trouble, right? When you see things at that valuation, I don't know when, but I know that, you know, you're going to get another shot at them, right? You made a perfect point. I think that's a great strategy. If you love the businesses, you know, make that wish list or that shopping list and target prices where you can make sense of the valuation. Don't just be a stock chaser and a ticker chaser. But anyway, one of the things that I kind of wanted to go off with you about and pick your brain on a little bit is that I think it's fascinating is looking at these overvalued conditions in these markets, you know, as crazy as they are. And you know, again, it may be a fruitless endeavor. It may be something that you can't even really figure out. But I think it's incredibly fun and extremely mentally stimulating, which is to talk about how it got here. And one of the interesting things I've seen this week, there was a Josh Brown went off on a rift about ETFs and, you know, how they're the only place to be and how they're not a bubble and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And that was responding to Michael Burry's comments about ETFs being a bubble. And for full disclosure, we have some ETFs in our portfolio for general exposure. As a matter of fact, we're a significant shareholder of Zig. Big fan of what you guys are doing there. But do you think, how much of a role do you think that this passive investing craze plays into these valuations? Because I see it forming really a reflexive cycle, right? You get people chasing these names because of the growth story in a low growth environment. I get that. And then as they enter these ETFs, right, the ETFs are just purchasing blindly. And so they're constantly doubling down and directing more money to these bigger names, to these hot names. What did you think of Burry's comments about ETFs, and what kind of role do you think they're playing, if any, into this overvaluation that we're witnessing now?
Yeah, so I tend to agree with Michael Burry's views on passive and indexing. I read his comment, and he's included ETFs in there. So ETF is just a legal structure that, so you could have it as a mutual fund or a limited partnership. There are lots of different ways of pooling investment capital.
Yes.
And an ETF has a lot going for it, which is worth understanding. You know, it has these beneficial tax characteristics that make it distinct from a mutual fund in that it's not a flow-through vehicle. So if the manager sells something at the portfolio level, it doesn't flow through to the end holder to pay tax on, which makes them a very attractive vehicle. So you're basically, it's easier for you to calculate your capital gains on it. It's where you buy it, where you sell it, provided that it's managed properly. What Burry is really talking about is the passive flows. So it's been such a good decade for the S&P 500 and for US markets. There's no other market in the world that's even come close to doing anything like it. There's no other asset class in the world that looks anything like it. And when you find something that has returns that make it look phenomenal, and then you can invest in it at a very low rate because these very big shops can provide for basis points, you know, for virtually nothing. They provide exposure to these to the S&P 500 or whatever the underlying index is. That attracts a lot of capital. And so there are lots of investors and lots of advisors out there who are looking at the last 10 years and saying, well, nothing else really worked. We should just be channeling all of our money into these indexes. And for the most part, these are market capitalization weighted indexes. So the bigger companies get more of the money. The little companies get less of the money. So every marginal dollar is always pushing. And this is that they buy regardless of valuation. They don't care about the valuation. They're only looking at the market price or the market capitalization. So the big companies see the majority of the flows. And that is what has made them so detached from the underlying valuation. And the little companies, they don't get much of the flow at all. So small hasn't really benefited from these flows. Big has been a big beneficiary of the flows. And the other things that are beneficiaries of big flows like that are momentum, which is stocks that have gone up a lot, stocks that are very big, and stocks that have been performing. And so the things that are missing out are value stocks, stocks that are small. Traditionally, those are the stocks that have generated the highest performance. But the last 5 years or so, in particular, have been anomalous in that most of the returns have been to the bigger end. That's not something that is normal. I don't know that it's necessarily, I mean, it's a bubble in the sense that the valuations are extremely stretched. The most expensive S&P 500 are getting close to the 2000 bubble peak, which was as expensive as it's ever been. And when they collapsed, they went down hard. The big men go down hard when the market crash comes.
Yep.
The more undervalued stuff, it's been pulling back for a little while. So the valuations there, if anything, they're starting to get cheap. So I think that Burry's right. I don't know that so much that ETFs are to blame, although ETFs are one of the market capitalization weighted index based ETFs that give you exposure to the very biggest part of the market. They are the very biggest ETFs, and they are the ones that have seen the most flows, and they are most likely the ones that are going to get hurt the worst when this reverses.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great distinction you made between, you know, ETF and passive. And for those of you listening, one of the things he's pointing to, when I first got in the industry, I saw this firsthand regarding the advantages you were pointing out to with an ETF. We had clients that were down 30-40% in the financial crisis in a mutual fund that went to sell their mutual fund and had a cap gain. They were not happy about that. And I don't think a lot of people understand that, because you inherit the cost basis when you buy in, and an ETF kind of, it eliminates that issue. Your gain is simply what you paid for it, like purchasing an individual stock, and which is why we use ETFs and why we're an investor in ZIG, your ETF. And so certainly ETFs are here to stay. I think they're incredibly valuable, but the whole passive thing, it's a different ball game. And it just, you know, like you were talking about, it just seems to me like this reflexive cycle, right? This capital just keeps flowing into these names and round we go. Another word you use that I agree with 100% is anomalous. It really is, you know, kind of, we're in no man's land. You know, the only thing you can compare it to is 99 in 2000 and, you know, maybe to some extent 1929. But, you know, I saw another thing out today. The official count, market cap to GDP is, what are we, right around 150%. You know, it's just, it's unbelievable. And now one thing I want to get to that I don't know that you and I have discussed at all, and I thought it was going to be interesting to run this by you. Do you look, I know you're focused on value and that's your game. Do you look at all at macro? Are you looking at the macroeconomic picture at all? And if so, are you incorporating that into your investment thesis? And if so, how?
Do you know, I follow it just to make sure that the individual company businesses aren't going to be so heavily impacted. Because, I mean, one thing that you have to follow very closely is the regulatory regime for each industry, each sector, whether it be in the US or whether it be internationally, just because that can have such a huge impact on the business. And that's one example of that is in financials, where basically what happens regulatorily that determines how well the business does. So you have to pay attention to that. I always make sure, you know, it's important to understand in some of the more cyclical names that are commodity based or, you know, producing steel or something like that. It's important to understand what the rest of the world looks like. The problem is that I find it extremely hard to invest on the basis of macro, because you need to get so many things right in series. And, you know, if you have like five things that you have to get right, five ideas that you have about how some big macro currency trade or something like that is going to play out, if each one of them has like a 50% probability of being right, if you've got five in a row, it's 0.5 by 0.5 by 0.5, you know, so on to eventually getting to the point where even if everything falls where you think it's going to fall, it's such a small probability of getting them all right. So I find macro really hard to sort of trade on, but I look at it at a business level, if that makes sense. And not so much at a portfolio level, but at an individual business level.
Yeah, no, that does make sense. I think we probably see it pretty similar. I probably follow it just based on listening to you and knowing you. I think I probably follow it even a little more intently than you do. But I see it much the same way, meaning that, you know, I'm watching the macro, the macro winds and all that kind of stuff. Really, what we're looking for is anomalous circumstances that can pop up. There's that word again, anomalous. But, these outside tail risks that can pop up on an economic basis that could, you know, violently impact some of the names that we own and how to protect against those events. But other than that, it's always funny for me to listen to a lot of these macro guys, because the thing that always pops into my head, and again, I find it endlessly fascinating. It's something that I like watching, that, you know, for all the reasons I just stated. But these guys that are trading on it and trying to get it right all the time, the thing that goes through my head constantly is, you know, like Solomon in the Bible referring to it as vanity and vexation. Right. Just like the amount of confidence that these guys have is always amusing to me. Especially in this marketplace, right? I mean, you get, you know, with governments and central banks willing to pull any lever at any given time. I mean, you talk about the ability to swing everything from one side of the boat to the other in the single stroke of a pen or the single push of a button. I just think it's gotten grotesquely complicated. It's never been easy. But I think of you often, actually, when I hear some of these guys talk, and I'm just like, you know, you
all
never
right, as is typical, about. We got to run due to time constraints. But if you want to catch the end of this interview, which I strongly suggest, you can go to knowyourriskradio.com.
You can go to our Apple iTunes page on bulwarkcapitalmanagement.com. You can get us on My Northwest, sign up for the podcast, and hear the rest of this great interview with Tobias Carlisle. Anyway, we've got to run. Have a great weekend. We'll be back next week. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
Thanks for listening to Know Your Risk Radio. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com. Tune in next week to Know Your Risk Radio with your host, Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.